Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Really appreciate your support listening on your favorite platform or watching on YouTube or nightly at 11 p.m. Pacific or 2 a.m. Eastern on DB&A TV at dbandatelevision.tv or streaming with the DB&A TV app, Amazon Fire, Roku, and Apple TV. Before we get to my conversation with Ted Sobel, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I can learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Ted Sobel is synonymous with LA Sports Radio, has covered every major sporting event you can think of and met all kinds of superstars, all kinds of stories in his new book, Touching Greatness, Tales from the Front Row with Heroes and Legends. We talk a lot about Kobe Bryant, Ted's boyhood idol, Elgin Baylor, and why Eli Manning and David Tyree tracked him down after their improbable Super Bowl win.
Yeah, it's been a struggle. It's been a tough year. I lost a few friends with COVID and family member, and then, you know, just recently Elgin Baylor passed away. He was a friend of mine since being a teen. That's one of the chapters in my book.
Yeah,
you know, I've lost about five people in the last 2 years that are prime subjects in the book who are not around anymore. And when you write that, you want them to be able to appreciate it more than anybody.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a giant hole there. But outside of that, I'm breathing. I got scenes. I can't complain.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm already rolling here, you know, just because I'm always so scared. Again, going back to the show up at a press conference with my Marantz and set it up and walk away without actually pressing record.
No, I got you.
That fear and anxiety. So the second I sit down, I just boop, hit record. I can always delete 8 minutes of silence.
Well, me and my buddy, do you know Paul Olden, who used to be in town?
The name sounds familiar.
Well, he's famous for the Tommy Lasorda tape. He's the one who asked the question. what's your opinion of Kink? That's 1976, I think, whatever it was.
What's my opinion? Anyway,
exactly. Well, this is a multi-volume book, and in the second volume there'll be a chapter called "What's My Opinion of Kingman's Performance," and it's the whole story about that day.
That's great. That's great.
We went to college together at LA City. So
was the Elgin Baylor chapter, and again, we could even just start here. Was the Elgin Baylor chapter always meant for the first volume?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Tell me about your relationship with him.
Sure. Well, it's funny because I always joke that I stalked him, but in a nice way. You know, there was nothing negative there. It was when I was in high school. I grew up in Culver City, and we moved to Doheny and Sunset area, right on the west side of town. And when I was playing basketball in high school, they said to me, "Hey, you know, you moved somewhere near where Elgin Baylor lives." And he was my favorite player by far. He was Magic Johnson. I say he was Magic Johnson before, or Michael Jordan before they were a zygote. Okay. I mean, this is like a long time ago. Right. Yeah. And so I said, well, I got to find out where this guy lives. So I didn't have a car yet. So I was hitchhiking up Doheny every day after school, hoping one day, maybe if Elgin Baylor drove by. Well, he never did to pick me up, but towards the end of that first year in school, I saw his car drive up. I looked in there and it was him. And so my motive in life for the next few months, whenever, was to find out where that car was parked so I could find out where he lived.
Oh, and nice.
Several weeks. And then it was a cul-de-sac a couple blocks up north of where I was, way near the top of the hill. And his car was there, and I knocked on the door, and his first wife, Ruby, answered the door, and I said, "I'm Ted, I'm a neighbor, and I'm a big fan of Elgin's. I'd just like to shake his hand one day, and it would be fantastic." She says, "Well, he's taking a nap." This is while he was still a player, right? This is 1969, and he was taking a nap, and she said, if you come back tomorrow at the same time, we'll be happy to, you know, have you meet him. I said, that's great. So I ran home and I told my mother, I said, Elgin Baylor's going to meet me tomorrow. She couldn't believe it. And she knew how much I love the guy, right? So I came back the next day and my heart was like this. As I say in the book, if I was as old as I am now, I'm sure I would have had cardiac arrest. There's no way. I was more nervous than any day in my life by far, right? So knocked on the door. Ruby answered, oh, yes. Hold on one second. Closed the door, and about a minute later, and I thought it was about 4 hours as I was just dying, you know, the door opens and there he is, and I'm looking way up at him, and he says, hi, I'm Elgin, as if I needed. No, I thought you were Will Chamberlain, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Anyways, instead of just shaking my hand and saying, nice to meet you, he invited me in, and we walked right into his trophy room, and we talked for a few minutes, small talk, just neighborly stuff, right? Say, hey, you know, look around. There's all my trophies if you'd like to see them. If I like to see them, I don't want to ever leave. And so I looked at the MVP trophies and the this and the that and the Seattle University. He was MVP of the NCAA tournament 1 year, even though they finished second. And so I was just relishing in this moment. It lasted maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And then I left. And as I'm walking away, he shakes my hand, says, nice to meet you. And you figure, well, that's the end of it, right? He's the neighbor. Congratulations. So as Ruby says, it was a pleasure to meet you. And she was about to close the door. A light bulb the size of Mars went off of my head and said, this can't be all. There's got to be more than this. So I quickly turned around and said, excuse me, Mrs. Baylor, would it be possible if I could go to a game with you sometime since I don't drive? And she looked at me like I was from outer space.
And well, like, wow. The light bulb was the size of Mars, so that makes sense.
Exactly, right. So I probably look like a Martian. And she said, you know what, let me ask Elgin, we'll get back to you. And that's all I needed. You'll get back to me? That'd be great. That means I get to come back again? It was pretty much that. And a couple weeks later, I knocked on the door again. She said, one second, asked Elgin, said, yeah, I guess. And they started taking me to games, more than one, got to be friendly with their kids, was shooting baskets in his backyard. This is while he was still playing. It was like heaven on earth. So it ended up, we remained friends, not close buddies, but friends all these years. And that was 1969.
Was that literally the first time that you touched greatness?
No, the first time I touched it. Thank you for that question. Yes, and the book's name is Touching Greatness. The first time I would say that I really felt it is the first sentence in my introduction in the book. And it was, I was about 7 years old, and my father says, I want to take you to Sears in West Hollywood, or it's actually was in East Hollywood, deep in Hollywood. And he said, Ted Williams is going to be there signing autographs, and I think you'd like to meet him. I was in Little League at the time, right? And he had just retired. All right, that's how long ago this was. So I think it was 1961. He had just retired, and he was famous. I remember, because I was watching, his last at bat was a home run. I'll never forget that. So it was like, wow, Ted Williams, that's fantastic. At that time, Aaron, he had just made a deal with Sears that he was going to put his name on everything. Forget baseball. His name was on football. It was a Ted Williams soccer ball. It was a Ted Williams whatever. Basketball. Yeah. It didn't matter. He was a big hunting guy, a fisherman. They had a lot of fishing equipment. Everything was Ted Williams, this and that. I think they even had Ted Williams barbecues. They had everything with right? So we get there and we're running late. And so we start to hustle through. And all the way in the background, we could see in the sporting goods section, he starts to stand. We see him because he's a big, tall guy. You know, the Splendid Splinter was his nickname. Stood up, and from far away, we could see he's getting up to leave. And my father hustles. My father was not exactly athletically built. Hustles over there, and I'm running behind him. And he goes, excuse me, Mr. Williams, but my son Teddy wants to meet you. And he stops. And I come running up, and he goes, "Oh, it's nice." And I remember looking up at him too. He was really tall to me. I was, 7 years old. So I look up, and he puts his hand into my hand, and he goes, "Oh, Teddy." He goes, "It's really nice to meet you. Another Teddy ball game." And he turned around and he walked away. And he was very, he didn't even stop to sign autograph. He was done. He wasn't being rude. He was finished, right?
Right.
Done with his public appearance. So I looked at my father and I said, "Wow," I shook Ted Williams' hand. And that's how I start my book. That is Touching Greatness.
As we get through, I want to obviously touch on some more stories and sure. Take us through the Lakers and the Dodgers and, all kinds of things. But in the 40 to 50 years that you've been, a big part of Southern California sports, watching it, covering it, being, just intimately involved in these games, how have you seen the impression of sports, both from the fan standpoint, but also sports' role in society?
Well, it's a very good question. And look, it's changed so much. Besides society changing, sports has changed. And it's interesting timing. We just had Jackie Robinson Day yesterday. And that's something that transcends sports so much. It's one of the most important moments in the history of our country. Forget sports, right? So it changed people's attitudes. That's what sports does. So I don't have any kids myself, but if I had kids, if they had an ounce of athleticism, I would say, please play whatever it is, because it teaches discipline. It teaches teamwork. It teaches camaraderie. It teaches honesty and so many things. So especially golf, by the way, that's the perfect sport where you don't have to say, "Hey, I need 14 people to play a game with me," right? Just go out and hit a ball. And if you cheat, you're the one who knows it, right? So anyway, sports has changed so much in the last several decades. And what I love being a part of is watching that change for the good and for the bad. Like right now, I grew up loving baseball, right? I mean, it was my entire life. My grandmother forced me to play piano when I was 5 years old. And I picked it up and I was really good right away. And my parents were saying, "Wow, I think we got a prodigy," right? I was playing by ear and I was just give me anything. I can hear it. I can play it. And about less than a year later, I say, "You know what? This is fine, but I want to play baseball. All my friends are outside. I don't feel like practicing as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. It was boring me to tears, which is one of the big regrets of my life that I don't play piano to this day. Anyway, what it did to me though was playing ball really got me into having great friendships, knowing that you've got people around you that want they have the same goals as you, and it's to win, right? It's all about winning. When you don't win, that's why I don't like one of the things in sports that's evolved. I don't like the trophies for fourth place.
The participation trophy, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, "Excuse me, thanks for showing up. See you next time. Try to win." Because where's the incentive there, right? There's zero incentive to, that's good enough. I finished 43rd and I got a ribbon. No, that's not good enough. This isn't professional golf where you get money just because you didn't make the cut, but you get $45 for showing up.
Right.
Anyway, that's the one of the negatives that the society has evolved in, but I love what sports teaches people. And the way baseball was before, it's not the same game anymore. It's slow. I once was in an elevator with Vin Scully, which was a regular basis, because when we would go down after a game,
right,
Vin would come on, they would drop him off, and we would go downstairs towards the clubhouse, right? So one game was about 4 hours and, 25 minutes. It was crazy long, like they can be at times. And Vinny turned to me, because I looked at him, like he was like, "We got to get out of here. This is a long night," right? And he looked at me and he goes, "Ted, do you know that one time I was involved in a doubleheader and it didn't take this long for both games and the intermission?" So, that's the way it used to be, Aaron, right?
Yeah, yeah.
2 hour games, it was 158, it was 212, it was whatever. They got to have commercials, they got to have 4,000 pitching changes. Nobody pitches complete games anymore. In that respect, it's not the same game. And it takes away from me. If I didn't play ball and wasn't passionate about it, I'm not so sure I could become a huge, passionate baseball fan these days. Tough to watch. Too slow.
And how about from the standpoint of athletes using their platforms in a way now that we really hadn't seen since Muhammad Ali?
Well, we actually have in a way. I mean, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar always was.
That's true. Yes. Yes.
He was one that was out there. Obviously, that era was Jim Brown, was Ali, was Kareem, and a few other guys would get involved in speaking politics. But they used to complain about Tiger Woods. He doesn't say anything. They complain about Michael Jordan. He doesn't say anything. And then when you say something, you're not supposed to say anything.
Right.
So you're a loser either way you look at it. It's unfair. Look, it's no different than some movie star who has the platform and has the people out there and say, okay, well, I can get 20 million clicks if I just say this. Why shouldn't an athlete be able to do it? Now, if he's going to be stupid and say dumb things, that's, you know, good luck with that, right? But if you're a bright guy like Kareem is one of the brightest guys of all time, forget sports. He's just he's a very, very intelligent guy. And he's written many books and he knows what he's talking about. And he's very honest and fair in what he says as well. So why shouldn't they say something? LeBron's getting ripped. By the way, the people that rip them usually aren't the ones that should be ripping because they don't have a whole lot to back what their point of view is.
Right.
They're ripping for ripping's sake. Sorry, that doesn't register in my life. You know, if the guy's got a brain and he's got a mouth, it's okay to use it. Now, if you overstep your bounds, and not that there is an actual boundary there, but if you get to the point where that's more important than your career, now you've gone too far. So you got to sort of tread water there and know exactly where you're coming from. But look, most of the guys that do this, who say anything, they're taking a chance. And you actually got to give them kudos for that.
Yeah.
Because they could lose, if they say something really stupid, they could lose a lot of money in whatever endorsements they have and potential future work. You never know.
If you could snap your fingers and go back to any one of three games that you've covered, that you've actually witnessed, what would those three games be?
Okay, well, one of them, I guess you couldn't call a game. We can call it round four of the Masters in 2019 when Tiger made his comeback. So that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
and the most recent, of course.
That still gives me goosebumps. Just thinking back to those moments. Gosh.
It was an amazing day. It really was. It was so unexpected. And it is a full chapter in volume one of Touching Greatness. My entire career, I should say Tiger's entire career covering him. I was there the first day he took a swing as a 16-year-old at Riviera. And I got to, that sort of capped it off. And I thank him in the book for like, that's very nice of you to close the chapter out perfectly here, Tiger. Local boy does good, right?
Yep.
That's included. Now, it's hard not to include, especially with what's happened since Kobe's 60-point final game, even though it was the most meaningless game ever.
Right.
The Lakers were so far under 500 and so far out of it. Nobody cared about the score. Nobody cared about anything in the game. Everything was hashtag thank you, Kobe. That was it, right? Nothing else mattered. But the way he did it, I mean, if you put that in a movie, you would say, sorry, it's too fictional. Get it out of here. Throw it on the cutting room floor. It's stupid.
Right.
The intensity in that building, Aaron, was truly amazing. And amazement is what I was at, and mostly, especially from about the several minute mark in the fourth quarter, because he was so exhausted.
He was just dog tired.
He was dragging his legs. I compare it to, if you remember The Mummy, the way he would walk with his leg behind him.
Right.
He could barely get down the floor, and he was huffing and puffing. And I was thinking, hey, the guy scored 45. Get him out of here. Standing, oh, great. His legs are going to fall off like an old Monty Python movie. You know, it was getting scary. So, but he just kept digging deep and digging deep. And as he said afterwards, it's the only time ever everybody's saying, shoot, shoot. Before it used to be, pass the ball, you ball hog.
Finally, after all these years, they're right. Like, go and ahead and shoot, saying, man, finally.
Kept, right, exactly. He kept saying, I don't know what to do if you tell me to shoot. It was so much fun.
Before we get to the third game, I do want to ask, we are talking about Kobe. Take me to the day he died.
Well, I was in Miami at the Super Bowl. I didn't go to the game. I was there for the Super Bowl experience the week leading up into it. I had a corporate gig. And so we were just promoting the Procter & Gamble stuff. We had games. We were playing some fun things. And our day was just getting underway. And some patron walked up and said something happened with Kobe. And I don't know why they would have said something to me, because they didn't know me. It was just somebody there who paid their way in. And I didn't know what they were talking about. So like, wow, I hope it's okay. And then sort of forgot about it for a few minutes when somebody said something really bad happened and Kobe Bryant's involved. And there was a TV way in the background at another booth. And I couldn't make out what was going on. So I said to the guys, can I have like 3 minutes off here? I need to find out what's going on. And I ran over there. And then the word had just come out that he was the one involved in the accident. And I just sat there. I remember I couldn't think. I couldn't talk. I just had to like take a bunch of deep breaths. Think, I just can't believe this has happened. You know, maybe they're wrong. Maybe it wasn't him. And then you started hearing stuff like, they had a couple of other names that were maybe he was on the flight. A few of the Lakers. I'm trying to remember who it was. Maybe you recall, but
yeah, I recall also the same that there was speculation that he wasn't exactly the only team member, but I don't recall the names either.
Yeah. Anyway, it was just literally heartbreaking. I mean, my whole body was in shock. And then I got a couple of phone calls saying, Ted, can you come on local NPR radio in LA? Right. Want to talk to me about Kobe? And it's like, I don't even know what to tell you. First of all, I didn't know what happened because I'm working. You know, I said, well, I hope you don't ask me about the accident because I'm working here.
I'm not even there. I'm 2,500 miles away. Right.
Yeah. Well, it was obvious, but they said, we just want to get, you know, they knew that I covered his whole career. And, I'm still to this day, when I think about it, I have a difficult time with it. I have a chapter on Kobe and Shaq that I finished way before that. And I thought it was only appropriate to add maybe a couple of paragraphs afterwards, my thoughts on Kobe, our relationship, what he meant to the city. And afterwards, it ended up being several paragraphs. I didn't even realize after I did it and I didn't look at it for a few months. And I went back and was like, wow, that might be a little too long, but it's everything I want to say. So I left it in the book. So it's in there. I have a story about Kobe that is one of my, I have a bunch of stories about him, but one of my favorites is in 2008, when the U.S. Team USA was playing with Kobe on the team and they were going to go to China. And Kobe was in Las Vegas for the last workouts before they flew to Beijing, I think is where it was, right? So I went to Las Vegas. I have family there. My mother was living there at the time. And I thought, well, I'll go visit them. I'll go to a practice, the last one, get some sound. I was working for KFWB at the time, like felt forever. You know, it was 23 years there, right? This was perfect. I take one day off and talk to Kobe, maybe Coach K and a couple other people. So I went there and thinking, well, I always get credentialed. And I called the Lakers up and they said, well, we can't credential you. You have to get a hold of this guy, that, but we don't have the contact number.
Oh yeah, because we're talking USA Basketball, whole other entity. It's not,
totally different. Exactly. So I looked around, I made a bunch of phone calls. Nobody knew who to call. And I'm there and it's one day left. And I just figured, well, I guess I'm not going to get the credential. So forget about it. Right. So I'm walking into randomly. I walked into a hotel off of the strip and went to grab something to eat. And a long line in the food section right in front of me, his back was turned to me. And I looked up and it was Kobe's security guy. You know, I mean, that's like one in a gazillion, right?
Right.
In Las Vegas, and you want to you want to hang out with Kobe? And there's a security guy. So I tapped him on the shoulder. He goes, hey, what's going on? I said, no, what's going on with you? How do I get into practice? He says, here's the guy's name. Here's his phone number. Call him immediately. Tomorrow we're leaving. You know, tomorrow's the last day.
Yeah.
I know.
That's why I'm here.
Exactly. So I called the guy up and they said, yeah, actually, I didn't reach this guy, but they said, come to a hotel. It was on the strip and that's where they were staying, but they were practicing at a local high school. So I get to the hotel. They said, you're going to have to go to this high school and that's where everybody is. Here's the guy's name to talk to. You're good. Fine. Five more minutes, drove to the high school. Walked in and the guy was, I asked somebody if he can get him. He came over and he goes, oh, I'm sorry. You know, this is something you got to do this in advance. You got to get a credential and fill out the form. It's the whole thing.
Right. Right.
I appreciate you coming over, but I just can't do it. So I tried a few different ways to ask him. It's like, well, I just want to get sound, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm a radio guy. 10 minutes. I stick a mic in somebody's face. They don't even have to look pretty. Let's go.
Exactly. I promise I'll close my see me. I'll just go like this.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So I tried everything and he said, I'm sorry, you can't do it. That light bulb went off again. Last second light bulb as I'm about to leave. I said, can you bring Kobe Bryant over here? And he looked at me like, yeah, sure. Whatever. No, I said, I'm serious. I've covered his whole damn career. Bring Kobe over here. Can I get him for a second? And he kept looking at me like, you're insane. I'm not bringing Kobe Bryant in here. And I said, please bring Kobe. I know the guy. I'm not making up a story here. And for whatever reason, he got up and I could hear basketballs dribbling on the other side of the wall in the gym. And he opens the door, closes it behind him, and about 2 minutes later walks over. Kobe walks out and he goes, hey, what the hell are you doing here? I said, well, I'm just trying. He says, get the guy his damn credential. We got practice to go. The guy gave me a credential. I walked in. That's one of my favorite stories.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I did not cover Kobe all that much. You know, I graduated from Cal State Northridge in 01. I worked for 3 years in Fresno, but then I spent 3 years in Miami in 04 to 07 working for the Heat flagship station.
Oh, okay.
And that was about the time that, of course, Shaq was traded to Miami, and they sent the Lakers to Miami for a Christmas Day game, I think it was, or you know, somewhere around there. It might have actually, the Christmas Day game may have been
That was in L.A.
In
the
L.A.,
first game
but
was in L.A., right.
Yeah.
That story is in my book, yeah.
So they send, so he's out there, of course, with the Lakers. They're not doing well. You know, none of the teams after Shaq left did any kind of
that's true
any kind of good. But
he left them the shambles, didn't he?
Yes, yes. So I I'm in the Lakers locker room, and I'm nervous as all get out, man. I'm only 5 or 6 years into my career. I don't want to. This is Kobe. This is the guy I've grown up watching growing up in L.A. And so I asked him. I said, you know, how tough is it to, you know, play in these marquee matchups and always feel like you've got a chance to win, but you come in here and, you know, it's not that way anymore. And he was so gracious. He was so professional. He, you know, it wasn't the last question. You know, you don't want to piss off the star and have him walk away. And then the rest of the gaggle looks at you like, dude, what did you just do? Why did you just do that? He was professional, answered every question, stayed as long as he needed to, and that's my Kobe story, but that's lots of people's Kobe stories.
Yes. Well, let me tell you, the opposite side of that, Aaron, is he's also the guy who has cussed me out more than any person ever times 10, okay? And I got a great story for you. You'll love this one, and it's Tiger Woods related. It's 2009, if I got this correct, when Tiger had his issues,
yes.
And his wife, his
09, wife, 10, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was 09, I believe. And so I'm covering the Lakers. I'm there almost every game, not everyone, but mostly, right. Game is over. This was a few weeks after it had happened, 'cause that happened on Thanksgiving Day. So I got Kobe after, a get together in the locker room, just another game. It was Tuesday night. Who cares? Right. Yeah. And as everybody broke apart, I said, Kobe, I got a quick question for you. I said, you're the only guy who can answer this question literally in the world, the only person. And I got you. So I'm going to ask you, I want to know your thoughts on the Tiger Woods situation. Because remember Kobe and the rape case and the whole thing,
right.
All that he went through. And, right. And I was there the whole time. It was crazy. It was uncomfortable. And, you know, he brought on some of that, obviously, himself. So it was the most comfortable feeling to ask him that question. But to me, it made sense. And he looked at me. Can I cuss on the air here?
Yes.
Okay, I'm trying to be professional.
Yeah, that's no problem. It's serious. It still takes me a little bit to get over that. Okay, I'm sitting in front of a microphone.
Exactly.
Can I curse? Okay, I can curse. Okay, go ahead.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm quoting Kobe anyway. So
yes.
Whatever. So he looks down at me. He goes, "Are you fucking kidding me?" He goes, "Are you asking me that fucking question? There's no fucking way I'm going to answer that." And John Black, Lakers PR guy,
yep. Probably long time.
Right. So John looks at me. He was standing about 5 feet away. He goes, "Ted, I cannot believe you had the balls to ask that question. I don't believe it. You're," and he kept saying that. He goes, "How did you have the balls to ask that question? He's not going to answer you. And not only that, I will be surprised if he ever, ever answers any of your questions again." I said, "John," I asked it respectfully. I didn't say anything in a way where, you know, I was fair. And he doesn't have to answer anything. So that's fine. If he wants to cuss me out, I'm used to it. No problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, he says he'll never, you're lucky if he ever speaks to you again. And this is the truth, Aaron. I said, "Whatever, you know, I got a job to do. I'm not here to make friends with him." Right. And I wasn't being antagonistic either at all. No, I mean, it was just a matter of fact kind of a thing. If you can't answer it, it's okay. I started to walk away because we were done. We were done in the room, right? It's inside the Laker locker room. I'm starting to walk out. And as I'm about mostly out the door, I get this arm comes wrapped around me and it's Kobe. He says, "That's bullshit." He goes, "Don't worry about it. John Black just talking ass." He goes, "It's all good." I said, "There's no way I was going to answer that fucking question. Don't worry about it." And he had his arm around me. Like, he walked out with me the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give you game number three.
Okay.
About the three games. Cause it's my favorite story, my favorite post game story ever. It was the Super Bowl where the Giants beat, upset the perfect Patriots.
Right.
About to become the only 19-0 team ever. They were 18-0 at the time. T-shirts were being made. Books were already being printed. 19-0. It's never happened. Blah, 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 blah. Right. So here I am in Arizona, and I don't cover a lot of Super Bowl games because, you know, I'm based in LA and the Rams are never in one. So I don't worry about that. And Chargers weren't here yet, obviously. So I would try to cover games because I'm fortunate that I'd be credentialed to a lot of these games if I needed to go. But a lot of time it was on my dime. Aaron, you know how local stations are.
Yep.
You have to drive past La Cienega. Well, the rest is going to be.
Well, that's why I didn't go to the, I think it's the 08, not the 08, 06 NBA Finals Heat at Dallas when Shaq and Wade actually won the title in Dallas.
Yes.
I didn't go to that because I would have had to pay for it myself. We didn't have anybody there as the Heat flagship station. We didn't have anybody in the building except for the play-by-play guys. Right.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. And I couldn't afford to go.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm a fool because I went to Wimbledon and the British Open 7 or 8 times and it was all on my dime. So what I did was, okay, well, it's an unbelievable opportunity.
Yeah.
They even told me, "You're the only local radio guy in the world outside of our neighborhood that we credential." So that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Right. So pretty lucky. So I said, you know what? At the first time, I'd never been to Europe. So I just wanted to go there. So I thought, well, I can cover whatever it is. And Tiger was playing and make it on a local flavor kind of a thing. And then I'll be on vacation for a couple of weeks because I still needed my vacation time. So that's how I figured it, and then write it off. So, but I ended up doing that every single damn year. It was a lot on your dime. That was a lot of dimes.
Yeah, that's a lot of dimes.
Yeah, exactly. So here I am at the Super Bowl. Game is over. They pull off the great upset. Before the game, I got there the last day that you could speak to the players for the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. right? So I had to make a choice because it was separate areas, separate neighborhoods between the Patriots and the Giants. And I decided the whole world's already at the Patriots. I'm going to go to the Giants. They had at least four or five guys that were from LA, a couple of USC guys. And I thought, I'll just go there, different angle. That's fine. I got there, did my work, interviewed Strahan, a few other guys. There was one guy left at a table. They had separate tables. They had the receivers table. They had the defensive backs table, all that kind of stuff. And then little name tags, right, next to them. So at the receivers table, there's one guy left. And his name was David Tyree.
I knew you were going to say that. That's great.
Remember that name.
That's great.
Now, before then, if I ever would have said David Tyree, you would have said, is he a bowler? Is he a wrestler? I mean, nobody knew who he was.
And I don't know of any other catch other than that one he made against his helmet in the Super Bowl. I don't know of any other catch before or after or any other catch in that game.
By the way, he never had another catch after that game. That was his last catch of his career.
Really?
The next year he got hurt in training camp and he never played again.
Oh, I didn't see.
He might have played in preseason game or something, but he never.
Nothing official. I didn't know.
And by the way, I think he had, it's off the top of my head, I want to say he had five catches that whole year.
Wow.
Up to the Super Bowl. Okay. So now I cover the NFL. I know the game. I knew his name. That was it. I didn't know anything about the guy. I just knew he was another guy on the team, right? So I don't even know why I said something, but me being who I am, I'm just sort of a little off the wall. I thought, let's have some fun with David Tyree, because in the back of my mind, I remember a buddy of mine who we would make bets, proposition bets in Vegas for the Super Bowl. We talked about David Tyree over under a half a catch. Because they'll have everything in there,
right,
you know?
Right.
It's like, will you step on the sideline three times? Are you wearing blue? Right? So they had David Tyree half catch, and I remembered it. So I thought, this is going to be something interesting. So I walked up and introduced myself. Hey, it's Ted Sobel with KFWB in Los Angeles. We have nothing to do with the Giants. We have nothing to do with the Patriots. But you need to know there is a proposition bet in Las Vegas with your name on it. And then I thought, wait a minute, he probably doesn't even know what a proposition bet is. You know, the average guy probably wouldn't.
Right, right. Right. And as athletes, you know, you're trained to stay away from that stuff. Right,
exactly,
right.
Exactly. So I asked him, I said, David, do you know what a prop bet is? He says, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I said, okay, well, here it is. It's a half a catch. So it's, will David Tyree have over a half catch or under a half? So it means if you get one and they bet over, they win. If they bet under, they lose. So he says to me, he looks at me, he goes, well, you tell those people, like I'm telling the best. He had no idea, but it was funny. I'll never forget it. You tell those people, you tell them to bet the overs, because I'm going to not only have a catch, but I'm going to have at least one important catch in this game. And I wouldn't be shocked if I'm the MVP's having, he's sort of becoming a wrestler now, right? But he's, like semi, he's like serious. And I'm looking at him like, David, if you have one target, it should be over under one target, right? Yes. Not one catch. That would have been the smarter prop bet. But anyway, so we had fun with that and explained it was really nice. He was really a nice guy. Forgot about it. Game goes on. We're playing. I'm packing up because I got a flight out the same night. I got to hustle my ass to the airport. And we're on the other side of town, in Glendale, Arizona, outside of Phoenix, right? And with the Super Bowl crowds and the whole thing, it was crazy. So we're coming down to the wire, and then Eli's scrambling and all over the place to get out of that one play. Looks like he was sacked 14 times, right?
Yeah.
And so they don't blow the whistle. They got him by the face mask. They got him by the jock strap. They got him by everything, and he keeps slipping away like he thinks he's some great athlete. And I don't even know if the guy could dance, right? So It's unbelievable. That play just, it was in writing. It had to happen this way. So he ends up making the play, and I saw it from far away because we were in end zone seats and they were on the other side, going the other way, right? And I saw it, and I thought, I couldn't tell exactly what happened. So I keep looking at my monitor thinking, I can't believe that. And then I realized that's Tyree. Now, remember, Tyree already caught. No, you wouldn't remember this. No. He already caught a catch. He made a nice catch before that. He caught a touchdown catch.
I don't remember the touchdown catch either. Yeah.
Nobody would remember that because it's David Tyree, and it wasn't the game deciding one.
Right.
He already scored and made another catch. So, you know, that bet was over, and I got a few laughs with my buddy on the phone over that.
Yeah.
And, you know, little did we know that this was about to happen. So he gets the thing on top of his head, and he's sticking there, and it's just an unbelievable catch. It really was. So the game is over, and I'm hustling, and I got to get my post-game sound and get this thing over with so I can pack up and get a cab and go to the airport. So I go down to the Giants locker room, and – I don't have a credential to get on the field. It only allows me in the locker room. They have a
right, special. Right. Yeah, the Super Bowl is so tiered. Yes,
exactly. So I can't get on the field, and so I thought, okay, I'm just going to wait at the tunnel. There was one security guard there, and he knew. I said, I'm not going to try and get on. I said, I just want to wait here when the guys come running off the field. I want to grab them because it's sort of like that's the adrenaline rush. They're still on a high, right? Run into the locker room. So I got all the guys that were there that I needed to get. Except for Eli Manning. Now, he's a Super Bowl MVP. Aaron, have you ever covered a Super Bowl?
I just one, yes. The Colts and Bears, that rainy one in Miami.
Okay. So Peyton, I guess, was he the
MVP? I don't know if he was the MVP. I didn't stay through the game. Pouring down rain.
All I could think about is
the next break in the rain, I'm leaving. Because I'm just like, you know what?
But you were there. I flew to Arizona. I wasn't leaving until I got my sound.
right. Yeah, no, I just wanted to go home.
I got you.
My experience is so much better just going home and being dry at that point.
Yeah, I always called that game, by the way, the illegitimate Super Bowl because Rex Grossman got the Bears to the Super Bowl. So to me, it was like, yeah, that's not a real one, right? Anyway, sorry, Rex, but, you know, just reality. Anyway, so I'm waiting thinking, okay, I wonder if Eli Manning is going to come out here and I might be able to get him. If you know anything about covering a Super Bowl, and I wouldn't expect anyone to know this, it is not only impossible, it is literally like you're dreaming and probably on a drug high if you think you even have a chance of getting a one-on-one with the MVP of the Super Bowl right after the game. And you're not with that, whatever network is covering the game, right?
Right.
So all the guys, I finished with them one-on-ones, all the guys. And I'm thinking, I'm just going to stand here and wait for Eli and see what happens. Here he comes, finally. He's got his new Super Bowl championship hat on. And he's got his T-shirt on over his gear. And there's about five guys around him, all in suits. So I'm thinking probably one of them at least is with the Giants. And the rest are probably league guys, you know, just walking him out. And they're going to walk into the locker room and then they're done. Right. So he comes down the ramp and I'm like in the middle of this tunnel area and it's an L-shaped ramp. So it's like straight down and then it turns to the left and that's where the locker room is. So I'm in the first part of the L. There's nobody there except for one guy. His name was Tiki Barber. And Tiki Barber used to be the running back for the Giants. And that was the year he retired. Just like out of the blue, he just said, I'm going to retire. I don't want to play anymore.
Right.
He was working for the Today Show. And he had a riff with Eli because he kept saying nationally, this guy can't lead him to a Super Bowl. He doesn't have the talent. He doesn't have the leadership, blah, 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 blah. And they hadn't spoken the whole year. They had a couple, I guess, tweets back and forth, stupid tweets. And Eli's not the type of guy who's going to be negative. You know, he's just a straight-laced.
Yeah.
He's not into that kind of stuff, right? But Tiki probably thinking, I'm on network TV now. I need to stir up the pot a little bit. So I guess, I mean, who knows what's in his brain. So here comes Eli down the tunnel and I'm standing there and I got my mic with me and I said, Eli, you're this, by the way, his brother Peyton had just won the MVP the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I said, this is unbelievable. Your brother won the, I'm just trying to come up with an angle so he'll say something to me. And he walks right over to me. I've never met him in my life, ever. I've met, you know, almost everybody who's anybody. I never met Eli, never played in LA when I covered a game. Just another guy, right?
Yeah.
But he walks over and he starts to give me an answer. And I'm thinking, I can't believe this. I'm getting a comment from the Super Bowl MVP. This is all I need. This is unbelievable. In the middle of his remarks, Aaron, it was unbelievable. Off my right shoulder, here comes Tiki Barber with a boom mic and another guy and his cameraman. And he said, excuse me, in the middle. He said, Tiki, he says something like, Eli, I'm with the Today Show now. I want to talk to you. He's talking to me in the middle of his response, right? And then he half-ass apologizes to me, saying, well, you know, I understand. I'm sorry, whatever. And Eli looked at him like, you son of a bitch. I mean, that was so rude, right?
TV guys, am I right? TV guys.
Totally. It was that kind of an attitude. It was like, you're a peon, get the hell out of our way. Besides the fact, you know, he's a former player and his teammate, and he thought he owned the moment. So Eli goes over, they go off to the side and they do their thing. Now, somehow there's like 150 at least people in line to go into the Giants locker room, but they didn't open it and they weren't going to open it until Eli walked in. So a bunch of the people started, like somebody must have said something. They said, Eli, this was the story. Eli and Tiki are talking because it was a big deal in New York.
Right.
They can't stand each other. And he just won the Super Bowl. Are they going to start fighting? I mean, who knows what's going to happen? The big deal. So this horde of people comes running over, and now they're all over the place. Now we've got security guards coming in and blah, blah. So there must have been, I don't know, 75, maybe 60, 75 reporters standing there. They're taking pictures of them doing an interview. That's just their story, right? So I just walk off into the far corner thinking, I just can't believe that Tiki Barber screwed up my one in a gazillion chance to do a one-on-one. Eli finishes the interview and they start to walk down again. And I'll never forget this. The security guys are saying, hey, open it up. Cause they're all sort of crowding around. He's not going to talk now. You know, he's going to go into the locker room. You get him there when it's time, no problem. So they open up like the parting of the seas,
right?
Walk through all this horde of people. And he's walking to this L shape where, you know, it turns to the left and that's where their locker is. And as he's getting close to the L where when it comes together, he starts looking around and he sees me way in the far corner and he walks all the way over to me. And I'm thinking, where is he going? What is this? He walks right up to me. I've never met him in my life, puts his arms around me and he goes, let's finish what we were doing. Now, come on.
Wow.
That doesn't happen in a billion times, but that was his upbringing. That's Archie Manning's kid. That's the way Archie teaches his kids. And he says, we're going to talk while I'm walking back. And you got about, like I said, probably 150 reporters standing there. And they're all looking at me like, who the hell is that? Eli, his arm around him. Some stupid radio guy from LA. They don't know who I am, right? It was so funny, but it's one of my favorite stories ever. And so that's half the story. The other end is, I'm in the locker room. Eli, we finish our little quick one-on-one. He says, are you good? I'm good. Thank you. That's very nice of you. And he walks in. We're done. And I'm thinking, I can't believe this happened. I'm reeling inside. Like, this is the greatest thing of all time. I will go in with everybody else into the room. And I get a couple of interviews here. And I'm just getting ready to leave. Peyton Manning's in the room. I got him one-on-one talking about his brother.
Yeah.
And literally just about to walk out the door to get out of there so I can catch my flight. And I see David Tyree in the corner. And I look at him and he starts to walk towards me. And I said, David, do you remember me? He goes, I told you I was going to do that. And I couldn't believe he remembered me. It's in the book.
That's great. That's so great.
And the other night I'm watching the NFL Network and I'm watching I think they just called it the 10 greatest catches of all time. And I'm wondering, I wonder where they got the Tyree catch. It was number one. And I'm thinking, that is so damn funny. I have a story about that one.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to go back to, obviously, growing up, you had such a love for sports that you were seeking out all these different athletes who were, you know, within your grasp.
Yeah.
Why did you choose, and what sparked your getting into radio, getting into media to cover sports and be a part of it?
Well, when I was in high school, when the Dodgers were on KFI, I think you've heard of that station.
A little bit.
Yeah. they used to be on Vermont Avenue down the street. I went to LA City College. And before I went there, they were on Vermont. And my favorite broadcaster outside of sports was a DJ named Dave Hull, the Hullabalooer. And he just passed away this last year, unfortunately, because he was a huge mentor of mine. And I really wanted him to read the story that I have about him in the book. But Dave was somebody that I just loved. I used to run home from school every day to listen to him do a show when he was on KRLA in the mid 60s. So here it was in the late, it was more about 1970, about 70 or 71, and the Dodgers are on KFI. So I got him to invite me over to his watch him do his show. And he didn't have a board op or anything. He did everything. And he played his own music. He did everything. And it was like, wow, this is phenomenal. I got really caught up into it. And I thought, well, this would be an interesting career if I can't be a pro athlete. And I played ball all the way up to American Legion ball. But I wasn't good enough. There's no way. And I'm not very big either. I mean, if somebody sees me, it's like, get him out of here. He's not a player. So anyway, it was to the point where I started thinking, okay, what maybe might I do after this is all up, after I'm out of college? And Dave's the one who told me to go to LA City College. They had a great radio TV department at the time. And I went there and I really got into it. And I thought for a while I might be a DJ until I realized I had zero talent doing that. It was hard. It looks easy, but it is hard, especially for the best. They're amazing. I mean, they're just incredible. And for you kiddies out there, a DJ is somebody who spins records.
No, you didn't.
But seriously, folks. Anyway, it's amazing. But you know, as the world turns, right? So that's what got me into radio a little bit. But I grew up with Vin Scully. I grew up with Chick Hearn. And I always thought, well, if I can't be an athlete, maybe I can talk about sports. Right. And by the way, the first interview I ever did one-on-one with anybody, including my sister, I mean, anybody, right, was with Elgin Baylor. It was like maybe, I don't know, a year after we originally met, I went up there to shoot some baskets in the backyard with his son. And I asked Elgin, I said, you know, I'm starting to think about broadcasting. Would it be possible to do an interview with you? And he said, yeah, no problem. And we did the interview. I'll never forget it, sitting down in that same room where all of his trophies were. And I remember putting the old cassette deck, whatever it was at the time, down and thinking, this is the second most nervous I've ever been in my life. The first was meeting him.
The first was when you were at the door for the first time, right?
Exactly. Now I got to interview him and I don't even know what I'm doing. You know, I had no idea. My technique, I still have it, by the way. It's so fun. You can hear the quivering in my voice. You can hear me like moving the mic from here to there. It's like unbelievable. But that he was Michael Jordan of the NBA then. And my first interview was Michael Jordan one-on-one. It was Elgin, of course. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just amazing. So that's really, that's the first one. And after that, I was like, I got to do this.
You were hooked. Yeah.
To do this. You know, I was hooked within seconds.
Do you have a digital copy of that or is it still on tape?
No, as I can say, I turned it into digital.
Yeah. Okay. If you wouldn't mind, if you think about it, to email me that, I can include that right here in the podcast. I'd love for people to hear that.
Wow. What, the whole thing?
Or no, I could just do a little snippet.
Fun. Absolutely.
Yeah. Be a pleasure. I think that'd be such a treat for people to hear. Yeah.
Yeah, I sound like my grandson or something, but I think I was just entering puberty late at the time. But
I'd love to hear that, though. I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
Oh, I haven't listened to it in a long time. I'm almost afraid to hear it. You know what? It would, now that Elgin has passed, I probably should listen to it just for sentimental purposes.
Yeah, for sure.
Today's guest on Sports Afield is the former captain of the Los Angeles Lakers, all-time all-star forward Elgin Baylor. At 6 feet 5 inches tall, Elgin was the third all-time rebounder in NBA history, fourth leading scorer in the top 10 in assists, and the most exciting player you'd ever want to watch. Pound for pound, probably the greatest all-around performer in the history of the game. Elgin, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Ted.
Have you missed the game of basketball as a player since your retirement last year?
Well, no, I haven't, Ted. I thought I would when I first retired. And the real test was right after I retired, I went to a few ball games, and I sat there and watched the game, and I didn't have any desire, really, to play. I got tired of playing. I had played practically 14 years, and I thought it was the time to quit, and I said once I quit playing, I would never play again. And I really don't have any desire to play.
How do you see the Lakers' chances of repeating as the world champions of basketball this year, and who are their strongest opponents?
Well, I think that the Lakers will repeat this year because somehow it seems though the league is out of balance, with the exception of about three or four teams. That would be probably the Boston Celtics, the New York Knicks, the Milwaukee Bucks, Golden State Warriors. They've been in and out. So I think between those three teams I name and the Lakers, these are the teams that will be in the playoffs. And I think the Lakers could win it this year. Right now they're playing the best ball in the league, with the exception of the Celtics. They're playing very good. But I don't think the Celtics have played the teams that the Lakers have played. Lakers have played all the teams, all the tough teams. So I think it could be very easily the Lakers against the Bucks. Again, I feel it, you know, might be those two teams.
Is the NBA stronger or weaker as a whole since the days when Bill Russell's Celtics?
Well, like I mentioned, you know, I think it's out of balance. I think the NBA is a little weaker this year because of the expansion. And I think what will probably happen, if they can get some good outstanding ball players from the college, last year it wasn't too good of a year for college pick. And you just have to have one of those years where it's a lot of good talent. Perhaps when Bill Walton comes out of UCLA, I think there'll be a lot of good ball players around, a lot of good big men, which most teams don't have. And it takes a big center to really build a team, because you build your foundation around a center. And if you don't have a great, good center, it's tough to have a winning team.
How do you feel a merger between the NBA and ABA would affect pro basketball?
It'd probably make it even weaker than it is now, because with the exception of about two or three teams in the ABA, they are not on the competitive level with the NBA. I think the weakest teams, probably NBA, could be a lot of the ABA teams, most of them. I don't think the teams will be merging, the two leagues, within the next 2 years at least. I've talked to some of the owners, and they don't think they will merge. And I know the players are very happy about it, because they have leverage when it comes to bargaining for salaries. The owners are crying because they want to merge, because they don't want to pay those big salaries. But until they do merge, they'll still be putting out a lot of money.
How has Bill Sharman changed this Laker team into the type of unit the Lakers have been looking for throughout the years?
Well, I think that the Lakers are probably there's more cohesiveness, more unity there, and I think that they have a great respect for Bill Sharman. Naturally, the talent is there, even though Sharman is a great coach, and he's putting together, and he's got Wilt playing the type of ball that winning basketball, the type of ball that Sharman perhaps thought that maybe Wilt should have been playing when he wasn't playing that type of ball. Wilt is not concentrating on scoring. He's concentrating on playing good defense, setting screens and picks, and getting offensive and defensive rebounds. And this is what it takes for a center to contribute, to help a ball club, make them a winning ball club. I think when you have a center that scores a lot of points, I think it hurts the ball club, because the way Wilt is playing now, just setting screens and picks and rebounds, there's more movement, and it makes him much more effective.
Can you convey your feelings on what it was like to come so close to winning an NBA championship and never really achieving one?
Well, I don't know. I naturally had many disappointing years. We've gotten very close, just a matter of a few lucky bounces with the ball. But overall, I think that I've had a lot of success. I've enjoyed playing. I think the Lakers have had a lot of success, because each year has been a winning year. It would have been different if we had a losing year each year, and then got to the championship and lost out. But the fact that we did have a winning season, so happened ever since I've been with the Lakers, we've been a winning ball club. We've had a lot of fans come into the place, the Forum, the sports arena, and I've been very happy with it, even though I didn't win a championship, but I've been very happy with my career.
Well, what was the biggest thrill in your illustrious career with the Lakers?
Well, I think probably the biggest thrill I got, I think probably was the first year when I joined the Minneapolis Lakers. They were in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the year before, I think they had won about 18 or 19 games. And the following year, the year I joined, they were picked to finish last in last place again. We did not finish in first place. We did finish in second place, but we went on to play the St. Louis Hawks then, now the Atlanta Hawks. And we beat them in six games. We won four. They won two games. And we went to the championship finals, naturally lose out to the Celtics. But I thought that was probably the greatest thing because I was a rookie that year, and to be a rookie in your first year playing for a world's title is quite an honor.
Well, could you name your five all-time favorite players you've faced or played with?
Well, that would be difficult, Ted, because to do this, you would insult a lot of other players because I think probably there are 15 or 20 outstanding players that's still now in the game and players that have played many years back. And it would be very difficult to name just five. You know, I could name you maybe 10 or 15 more players. But it would be difficult to name just the five outstanding players because I don't think it would be fair because you judge a player by what he can do, you know, for the team, you know, not how well he's playing or the points and things he's scoring. It's what the team does. Just like Vincent, I'll say Bill Russell. He never scored a lot of points, but he won a lot of championships, so that tells the story in itself.
Well, among all the great names, Elgin, I'm sure yours will be included. And I'd like to thank you very much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much, Ted.
Thank you, Elgin.
Just unbelievable.
What year would that have been? 1962?
That would have been... No,
1969. No,
it would have been probably 1970 or 71.
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking of the Ted Williams year. Yeah, when you were...
No, that was not when I was six.
Right, right. But yeah, so about 70, 71, yeah. Yeah,
70 or 71. In there.
Okay, right. Okay.
And he was still playing... And they had just lost to the Celtics in 69 on that really crazy Don Nelson shot that hit the back of the rim, bounced to hit the clouds and fell straight through when the balloons were in the forum. And I got the whole story. It's crazy. He was dying about all of that because, remember, he never won a legitimate championship. Yeah. On the Lakers won 33 in a row the day after he retired. That's when it started, that thing. And then they won the champ. They gave him a ring, but, you know, he didn't feel like he earned it. But at least they gave him a ring. There's a great picture of me with Elgin at his statue, which is I worked for years to try and get those people to recognize. I mean, I'm not responsible for it, but I tried whatever I could to say, there can't be a statue here if there's no Elgin Baylor statue. It makes no sense.
Right.
Los Angeles Lakers without Elgin.
Yeah.
They were going bankrupt. So anyway.
No, I appreciate it, though, Ted. Thank you so much for this. Problem. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much. I love to reminisce, and maybe we do this another time. We could talk about the history of L.A. that I have in there, because I love talking about the food and the restaurants and what it used to be like here in the 60s and the 70s. And music. I got a whole chapter called Laurel Canyon Days.
I'd love to have you back. Thank you.
Great stuff. Thanks for the invite, Aaron. Pleasure.
You can watch this episode on YouTube and DB&A TV. Follow the Aaron Bender podcast on your favorite platforms and link to it at aaronbender.com. That's also where you can find all my social media. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, aaronbendermedia@gmail.com. Be well, and thanks for listening.